Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Milo Nipo to contend, Umbati Bakaja Hufika.
Mais chibango,
dois,
check it out. You You played yourself a call. Does anyone see?
You gotta go
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, December the 28th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story deals with the situation in Chad. Candidates for Chad's local and parliamentary elections are holding their last rallies ahead of voting, which takes place on Sunday. In the capital of N'Djamena, residents and young people decry poor representation. They want the election to produce better leaders for the city. There are a lot of things to be done. The city needs a lot of things for its urbanization, said Tajo Jabongodi, a resident of N'Djamena. But disenchanted by the outcome of the presidential vote in May, many do not think Sunday's exercise will bring much change. We don't have a real candidate who's going to win, so I am not expecting anything. It won't be any different from the elections that have already taken place, said Samadar Abdu in N'Djamena. The ruling MPS party has been exhausted, every avenue to hold on to its majority. Its leaders say they aim to win all the seats in the town halls and parliament to hand President Mahama a stronger mandate. The party of the runner-up in the presidential election and former Prime Minister of Success Masra party is boycotting the exercise. Chad's opposition is deeply divided and fragmented, with little means to mount any meaningful challenge against the ruling MPS. The election comes just 7 months after the presidential election, which extended the Dibe family rule over the Central African oil producer. In other news, an alliance between Joseph Kabila and Moise Katumbi seems to be forming as the two Congolese politicians have united in their criticisms of the Democratic Republic of Congo's current president, Felix Tshisekedi. According to their teams, the two men met in Ethiopia not long before Christmas Day. More recently, they issued a joint statement underlining shared objectives. The statement deplored the worsening security situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the M23 rebels have captured swaths of land in the east, the men condemning the presence of illegal armed forces. It called on political force to unite efforts against what it described as a, quote, dictatorship, unquote. Both men are accused by Kinshasa of collaborating with Rwanda, which the UN has in turn accused of backing the M23 rebels, waging an offensive in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The last time the two men were seen together was at a forum in the DRC in 2022, during which the former rivals shook hands. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. French energy giant Total Energies is scrambling to unlock billions of dollars in frozen U.S. funding for its natural gas project in Mozambique. The multinational wants the $4.7 billion loan from the Exim Bank of the U.S. approved before President-elect Donald Trump takes office June, Afrique reported this week. The bank had approved the credit back in 2019, but did not proceed as Islamist violence in the Cabo Delgado region forced Total to pull staff from the project in Afungi. Total has since contracted a consultancy firm to carry out lobbying work in Washington. It fears that the new administration could bring about bureaucratic delays or impose new conditions. The outbreak of post-election violence in Mozambique has also raised concerns in Washington. But in a letter to U.S. authorities on December the 3rd, Total boss Patrick Pouyanné sought to reassure Washington's, writing that the security situation in Cabo Delgado has remarkably improved. Finally, Senegal's prime minister said on Friday that the government is closing all foreign military bases, an announcement essentially aimed at France, the West African nation's former colonial power. Although Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko did not specifically name French troops, no other foreign forces have military bases in Senegal. France has suffered similar setbacks in the several West African countries in recent years, including Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso, where French troops that have been on the ground for many years have been kicked out. Sonko made the announcement during a general policy statement to the National Assembly without providing a timeline for the exit of the French troops. It comes a month after Senegalese President Bassirou Diomaye Faye said there would soon be no more French soldiers on Senegalese soil. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And, of course, we're going to, at this time, take a break, and we'll, of course, remind you.
Hello and welcome, dear viewers. Today's episode broadcasting live from the heart of Beirut, and I'm your host, Farah Hatwi. The Israeli army has redirected its attention to Lebanon, warning of continued bombings deep within the country. They stated, "We will remain in Lebanon beyond the 60 days specified in the ceasefire agreement until the Lebanese army controls the south." Now, many Lebanese politicians and officials regard this escalation as dangerous, viewing these actions as an occupation and asserting that Lebanon has the right to defend itself and sovereignty and national dignity. In today's episode, we will highlight what is Israel's goal with such provocative actions. How patient will Hezbollah be in response to these violations? If Israel persists in disregarding international norms and ignoring the calls of world powers to halt these actions, could we face a collapse of the Lebanese-Israeli ceasefire agreement? And will the anticipated visit of the U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein to Lebanon help prevent such a breakdown? I'm joined here by Mr. Ridwan Rizek, a political analyst. Hello and welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Ridwan. Before starting our episode and focusing on Lebanon, as we highlighted in the introduction, we have to actually inform our viewers of a very important matter that happened this morning concerning Yemen. Israeli media reported that an air raid sirens have sounded over a large part of the occupied territories following a missile attack from Yemen. According to the Israeli regime media, the missile strike targeted Tel Aviv early Friday, today, this morning. The attack prompted Israeli settlers to rush into the shelters. Israeli's emergency services reported that 18 settlers were injured in Tel Aviv while attempting to reach the safety of the shelters. Now, of course, the most important factor is that these shells were not stopped here, and videos shared online showed Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system failing in intercepting these rockets. Of course, these are the latest news coming in from Yemen. We will discuss it in the second part of our own episode. But allow me here, Mr. Ridwan, to start with Lebanon, as today marks the 31 day since the ceasefire took into effect between Israel and Hezbollah, or came into effect. However, Israel's violations of Lebanon's sovereignty continues. The latest was yesterday, when we saw these very irritated images in broad daylight, where Israeli forces advanced into the Lebanese border and through Al-Qantara and Atshit Al-Qusair, heading towards Wadi Al-Hajir. The incursion lasted for several hours. Why is Israel, in your own opinion, moving around freely on Lebanese territories despite a ceasefire deal, UN calls committee that's overseeing the implementation of this deal?
Well, the invasion, or what's so-called the violation of the ceasefire, happened or took place yesterday, especially in Wadi al-Hajir, as we know that they still have the guilt feeling of the Wadi al-Hajir resistance in 2006, where the massacre of the Israeli tanks took place in that area. And during the last war, they wouldn't dare even to come near Wadi Hujair, because they still fear and remember the fierce fighting or resistance came from the Hezbollah fighters in 2006, where about 75 Merkabas were destroyed in 2006.
It was the graveyard of the Merkabas.
Exactly. So, by invading, they are trying to lift up their morale and broke this kind of guilt feeling or the bad remembrance of the 2006. And second of all, they want to assure the Lebanese resistance and the Lebanese government that the Israelis has all the rights to invade anywhere, to attack anywhere inside, deep inside Lebanon, and even coming to most of the villages where they couldn't invade during the war. They came to these villages after the ceasefire and kidnapping people, destroying houses much more than what has been destroyed during the war. Mm-hmm. So with no attention or intention of the UNIFIL or the the committee to stop or to be able to stop the Israelis from doing so. That means, bring us to a conclusion where that we understand that the Americans gave the green light to the Israelis to do whatever they want to do during this ceasefire period. Mm-hmm. And if we want to recall the some of the speeches coming from some of the Israeli announcements, that they said that they have no intention to withdraw from Lebanon after the ending of the ceasefire term.
Yes, we will come to that point because it's a very important point to highlight. But going into Wadi al-Hajair, isn't that considered a very dangerous escalation from your own point of view, Mr. Ridwan? It's a dangerous development and a serious threat to the implementation of 1701.
Of course. And this is a message to all people around the world that who were calling and asking to implement the 1701. It means nothing to the Israelis. It was a ceasefire needed by the Israeli army in order to regroup and refuel their army. But they needed that period, and now they got this period after the pressure came on Lebanon and the resistance to stop the war, or at least to accept this kind of ceasefire. Now,
do you see it as a trap? The ceasefire, do you see it as a trap?
I don't want to say it's a trap, but
it's not working for the favor of the Lebanese.
It's not the changing.
It's not working in the favor of Hezbollah, as you're highlighting, because they're also targeting the ammunitions of Hezbollah.
No, it's not working in favor of the Hezbollah. And second, that proves to everybody around the world that the Israelis respect no kind of commitment or convictions. So this why we should understand that the Israelis has a plan, they have a plan, and they are going to go according to their plans no matter what, without a deal or with no deal. So they will at any time, any chance that they got to do their job, they will. And that's and we will come across what's happened in Syria, mm-hmm. also 30 days ago, where they have an agreement since 1974 and they broke it. And they didn't give any respect to this kind
disengagement agreement I'm talking
about.
Yes.
So they invaded the whole Golan Heights again. This is the enemy that we are dealing with.
And now also they are talking about a ceasefire between Gaza and Israel. That's also Hamas is being cautious for it not to be a trap also that can be implemented on the Gazans and on the Palestinians, just the same way that it's happening inside Lebanon. A ceasefire has been dealt with, a ceasefire took action, and again we see breaches and violations of the ceasefire and disregarding international norms, as you are highlighting. Here to give our own viewers more information about Wadi al-Hajair, this area that Israel advanced into yesterday inside Lebanon. Wadi al-Hajair is a valley in Jabal Amel, adjacent to the Israeli border. It lies between the districts of Marjayoun, Bint Jbeil, and Nabatiyeh. The valley extends from the Litani River below the city of Nabatiyeh to the town of Aitaroun in Bint Jbeil district. The Israeli incursion into Wadi al-Hajair is the first of its kind since October 1st. The start of the Israelis ground incursion in Lebanon, and since the ceasefire came into effect in November 27. What was the real aim behind provoking, teasing, hitting on Hezbollah, dragging Hezbollah into a war? How do you read this action specifically?
I think they want to, first of all, they want to reach and see if they have, could find any kind of Hezbollah
weapons,
infrastructures, okay, in that area. They want to make sure that they will clean this area, controlled area, by the Israeli army. After the ceasefire took place, they want to find some weapons or tunnels or some kind of other rocket launchers to destroy. They are destroying the whole infrastructure. This is first. Second, they are trying to make the 5 kilometers depth into the borders unlivable by the civilians in that area. That's why we are seeing that they are destroying many of the houses inside the villages. And what we saw in Kfar Kila yesterday, it's a big proof about that, because those houses who were attacked by the bombing during the war, they are being demolished now by the Israeli army itself after they going in and out as they see that they need to do so. Okay. So, and second, they are trying to drag Hezbollah after they have regrouped and rearranged itself, to drag Hezbollah into a second battle where they have the upper hand now, because Hezbollah is not stationed in southern of Litani River, mm-hmm. and they are being held by the Lebanese army and the UNIFIL not to do any kind of operations that will
so
be.
So they only needed a break.
Exactly.
Break,
we can call it a trap. We can call it a trap. Mm-hmm. We can say that the Israelis needed that break in order to relaunch another attack to demolish Hezbollah, and the next aim will be, we will not be surprised, I don't want to scare people or the viewers, that Beirut will be the next target to the Israeli army.
Now, as you speak, we kind of remembered Prime Minister's speech before a ceasefire was implemented, speaking about Benjamin Netanyahu, when he highlighted that the soldiers, Israeli soldiers specifically, they needed a rest.
Yeah.
They needed it. He used that terminology. He used that word specifically, that they needed a rest. So obviously, according to your own analysis, this is the rest that they're having.
Exactly.
The ceasefire deal, the 60-day ceasefire deal, is the rest that they are actually asking for and they are having right now. Okay. The army, the Israeli army discussed that the presence in southern Lebanon, alleging that the Lebanese army had failed to implement the terms of the ceasefire agreement, particularly when it comes to this armament of Hezbollah. That's according to the Israeli army. When asked why these violations and why these breaches inside Lebanon, this is a ceasefire deal and this should not be happening, the answer was, well, the Lebanese army has failed to implement the terms of the ceasefire agreement, particularly its disarmament of Hezbollah. Now, we're not only talking about the trap inside the ceasefire deal, but also we are speaking about misinterpretation, lack of understanding by the Israelis of this ceasefire deal, of some of the terms and some of the conditions listed and negotiated upon, in your own opinion, because according to them, the Lebanese army is supposed to actually go against Hezbollah and take the weapons out. And that's why they are doing what they are doing.
The aim behind these kind of talks coming from the Israelis are the main target is to ignite a war or clashes between the Lebanese army and the resistance.
But how do you view this
resistance reason,
Mr. Redouane? Blaming Lebanese army.
Lebanese army, they have been calling for to deploy the Lebanese army along the war, along the borders for many, many years. And now when we see the Lebanese army is going or trying to go along the border, to be deployed along the borders, being stopped by the Israeli army. And we all know that the Lebanese army couldn't go into Khiam for 3 days until they have arranged it with the UNIFIL. So how can the Lebanese army operate if he cannot go into the villages occupied by the Israeli army? And what's the proofs that what's needed from the Lebanese army? What do they need? They want the Lebanese army to do? To go into search house by house, or to find some kind of tunnels or weapons? It's all now. It's the area northern of south of Litani River. It's all cleared from the resistance committed to the ceasefire and the 1701. So I think this kind of talk. It's just poisoning. That's just the speech. They are seeking and they are looking forward for some clashes that might take place between the resistance and Lebanese army, and then the Israelis will stay or stand watching and, you know, their job being done among the Lebanese themselves.
Even the Lebanese army is being cautious with this redeployment because, of course, we all know how the Israelis are targeting the Lebanese army several times. More than 40 Lebanese army has been targeted during the war. And now, of course, the Lebanese army is calculating every step because they do not trust the other side. This is a very important factor also.
It was a very important point because during the meeting of the committee in Nakura, the Israeli army invaded Nakura and destroyed most of the village. During the meeting of the committee inside Lebanon, in Nakura village. So that couldn't be more, ugly, couldn't be uglier than that, and couldn't be more stupid and stubbornness that's controlling the Israeli government with such issues. So the Lebanese army is trying to do their job with what they have, what equipment they have. They have no equipment, we know, where they are not armed to do the job on defending the country. So who can protect the sovereignty of the country if the Lebanese army is not well prepared, is not prepared at all with the weapons and what's needed to defend the country or to confront the Israeli army? So now everything happens coming in the favor of the resistance choice taken by the Lebanese people, whoever will agree or disagree with this. The only choice for us as Lebanese to be able to, reserve our sovereignty is to keep the resistance well equipped, well armed, and ready to resist or to fight this kind of brutal aggression coming from a brutal enemy.
Okay. The incursion, the recent one, forced families in Al-Qantara to flee to Al-Ghanduri at the western edge of the valley. Also, we're seeing people flee from certain areas because of this Israeli breaching of the ceasefire deal. This act prompted warnings from the Lebanese army and UNIFIL for sure. As a Lebanese security source expressed concern, stating this incursion into previously untouched areas, as you're highlighting, accompanied by extensive bombing or operations, is a significant expansion of Israel's enemy occupation map and recalls the border zone Israel established in the 1970s through firepower and occupation, which it withdrew from entirely in 2000. Will these calls halt Israeli actions or pressure it to stop the invasion?
No, I don't think so. No, I think it will be escalate as Trump will take over the office, because they have a very huge plan concerning the new Middle East, and this new Middle East will keep on going. And the plan will keep on going, and the Americans are still forcing and supporting all this plan to create what's so-called the New Middle East, which contains the Greater Israel. So later on, if you want, we can go on the Syrian file to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. In 1 month time, what's the Americans and the Israelis achieved in the last couple of weeks in Syria, which is very important, and it will reflect on the position of Lebanon.
But however, many analysts actually disagree with what you're highlighting, Mr. Ridwan, because they say that Trump does not want war in the region, especially after he said that he wants all the U.S. soldiers to go back and to withdraw from Syria, and he does not want to see any war in the region because he's coming up with new economic ideas. And that's his major focus. They disagree with this scenario. And some even say that Trump pretends as if he's on good terms with Benjamin Netanyahu. But Benjamin Netanyahu became a headache to him. And he wants to start this, or he wants to be inaugurated, and he wants to start this presidency with a new page, with a new agenda that is war-free. Do you agree to that?
No, I don't agree at all. Mm-hmm. Because it's not up to Trump to decide the foreign policy in the Middle East. The President of the United States has a great, power, but after all, this is not his final decisions. Second, if he is...
Then who decides?
Let's say that's the heading government in America, the decision makers who we don't see on medias or in public. So those are who decides the plans and the whole operations taking place in Middle East. But if I want to go along and agree with what they're saying, that means we have another 30 days before Trump's got to the office that he will finish everything, every war. He will finish the war in Gaza and will finish the war in Lebanon in the favor of Israel. That's not the conflict will we stop when somebody or one enemy wiping off the others, stopping or not having a war. Trump didn't say that's ending the war. He said we will stop the wars. How? In whose favor is going this war or these wars taking place in the Middle East will be stopped? So after Gaza being wiped, after the Hezbollah being smashed, after get rid of Bashar Assad, who were supporting the resistance groups and supplying all arms, opening it, all the hidden channels to fly over to Gaza, to Lebanon, even to the Palestinians everywhere for those Palestinians groups and organizations to be armed and ready to resist or to fight the Israelis. Now we are seeing that the most important castle of the resistance in the area is being now put aside by overthrowing Bashar Assad.
On Thursday, Israeli media reported that the Israeli army is preparing for the possibility of remaining in southern Lebanon beyond the 60 days outlined in the ceasefire agreement. Is that possible? And if yes, what will be the implications? And how will Hezbollah perceive this new information?
Well, that could relate to what I was saying now. That's the main aim to invade first to Saida and second maybe to Beirut. It's up on their ability to do so.
Why do they need more time beyond the 60 days outlined?
Now they need more time. That's why we can see that at the signing, the night signed the ceasefire, they invaded Aleppo the same night. So, and then things escalated. In 1 week, they have reached Damascus. So now the resistance, if I want to be very clear and admit that we are in a very critical situation.
Yes.
Because we might find and replace the armed supplies coming from other places rather than Syria. So now they are trying, and the invasion of coming from Golan Heights, controlling the Haramon mountain, and then closer, 8 kilometers closer to the passage highway from Damascus to Lebanon, which is mean that they can cut this road at any time they want. So now the Lebanese resistance could be surrounded or surrender from everywhere. Not from the sea. We have the German who are controlling the sea in the favor of the Israelis, and we must not forget the kidnapping of Mr. Amhaz from Batroun.
Yes.
With the permission and under the eyes of the Germans. Second, that the arms were fleeing into Lebanon. Now it's cut off. Because the new government in Syria will work in the favor of the Turks and the Americans also, and sometimes they are sending some love messages to the Israelis that we are tired of wars and we don't want wars again, and so they don't want wars anymore.
Yes.
So that means, with all the meaning, after the destroying of the whole Syrian army, mm-hmm. with the permission of the new government, with the permission of the Turks and the Americans, they have destroyed all Syrian bases, air, sea, and ground. So now we are seeing that Syria has no more nails or wish to go into any kind of conflict with the Israelis. So we can say that we have lost a great support.
So you're saying that the environment or the atmosphere encourages Israel for this new, or for the possibility of remaining in southern Lebanon beyond the 60 days outlined in the ceasefire. The entire, you're reading it from a different perspective. You're reading it from the Syrian side, from the Lebanese side, from the Lebanese government also side. However, will Hezbollah accept this?
No, Hezbollah has no choice. Look, let me tell you something very clear. As a resistance supporter myself, I can say from a different point of view that we have no choice, no other choice left but to resist. And what's most disappointing, that this Lebanese government, which is now we are hearing what they are saying, I've heard that a call was made between Mr. Najib Mikati, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, and Mr. Al-Julani. I still call him by his real name, Al-Julani, you know, the fighter who was, you know, killing in his hands in Syria during the civil war, congratulating him for freeing Syria. So was Syria under occupation under the Assad regime or Assad presidency?
Yes, but the Lebanese government has been actually highlighting that it is supporting this ceasefire deal, and they also, the Prime Minister Najib Mikati also highlighted that if these breaches continue by the Israeli side, you cannot guarantee what will happen next. And there is this kind of unity between the Lebanese government and Hezbollah concerning the file of the ceasefire agreement.
So
isn't that very for the advantage of Hezbollah or for the advantage of the Lebanese people, this unity that we see within the two sides?
Because as I was coming to the studio, I've heard on the news that 800 violations to the ceasefire took place in Lebanon.
Yes. 800 since its implementation.
Since the implementation of the ceasefire, okay. In 1 month. So that means about 20 a day. Despite the ground operations taking place, this is considered one violation.
Yes.
But it's a, you know, big or great operation taking place. Hezbollah is making a very, very high self-controlled, not to be...
Till when?
This is the question. Till when can Hezbollah? Because he cannot...
Especially if they're thinking of staying and remaining in southern Lebanon, even after the 60 days outlined in the ceasefire agreement.
The question must be asked to the Lebanese government, what will you do to free the Lebanese soil?
Here, in order to understand the Hezbollah silence towards this, and you're saying that they are maintaining a very pretty much sufficient control on their own actions because they do want to abide by the international law. But at the same point or at the same time, do you think that they're also sending messages to the Lebanese government and to these politicians opposing the mission of Hezbollah and always calling for dismantling Hezbollah and that the weapons should only stay with the Lebanese army and not with Hezbollah? Do you think that the silence can be understood from Hezbollah's side as a chance for these opposing Lebanese politicians and officials and the government to check what they can do when Israel breaches our own sovereignty?
No, I think that Hezbollah is, you know, cornering those people and putting them in a very bad position. Because they wanted...
Giving them the chance.
It's not giving them that. Let's say that he wanted to delegate the responsibility of defending the country to the Lebanese government. on to the opposers of the resistance in Lebanon. Now the Lebanese soil has been being invaded every day. You come, as you called yourself the protector of the Lebanese sovereignty and the great protector of the great Lebanon and the independence of Lebanon, see what can you do to free the country or to just to make the or force the Israelis to withdraw. Since the Israelis has no respect with any kind of commitment coming from anywhere, and no one can force it. And what's most surprising, I was hearing an American official saying that they came to Wadi al-Hujair to do an operation, and then they will withdraw after 5 hours. Yeah. As if you are allowing and giving them the chance, and you are giving the, you know, permitting or permission to go into the villages, do whatever they want, and they will withdraw. And then that's an integration or a violation to the Lebanese sovereignty and
just
dignity?
There's the same way the Americans actually described the Israelis' violations as incidents. When they were asked about how would you comment on these violations on Lebanon, they said, well, these are incidents. They underestimated, just the same way that you're highlighting, they're kind of justifying every action. Okay, the northern Israeli settler residents, let's hear speak about that. The northern Israeli settlers called for the establishment of a buffer zone along the Lebanon border to ensure their safe return to the area. The Israeli Haaretz newspaper this morning reported that the army has begun establishing infrastructure for military posts along the northern border, with some of them located on the Lebanese side of the border. What's your take on that?
Well, this is what I said. That's why they are destroying all the infrastructure and making those villages unlivable.
Because of the buffer zone
unlivable.
That they want to
because
create?
Because the buffer zone that they want to create, and in order to convince that the settlers to return to
the
their to settlements.
Yes.
So this is where... Will this happen with the permission of the Lebanese government? And will we accept this kind of violations coming from the Israelis with the permission or with the coverage of the United States and the British also? We must not forget those devils. And the Lebanese government, and how can we trust others on our life, where all evidence and incidents that proves to us that those cannot be, will give us no mercy, no rights, and no respect whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So to make it very short and very clear, what's happening now in the South, it used to happen since 1948.
Yes.
These violations took place, and the southern people, or the people who lived in the southern Lebanon, have suffered and experienced agony coming from the Israelis by invading in their villages every single day since 1948. And we all remember that massacres took place in some villages since 1948, 1950, 51, 52, 56. And also the invasions that coming, short invasions and incidents or operations, limited operations inside Lebanon, and even kidnapping people from the Lebanese soil.
Yes.
And also coming along, putting some kind of control points at the shore of Saida, at the shore of Ghaziye, at the shore of Sarafand, and they have kidnapped people from those places since 1972, 1973.
And still doing that up till now, even if
exactly.
Even when a ceasefire is implemented yesterday, they also kidnapped them.
The only time that we felt that we are safe, it's after the 2006. And after that time, the Israelis stopped violating the Lebanese soil.
Okay, Hezbollah MPs yesterday had their own comments towards these violations, and I registered some of them. We will highlight them together. Hezbollah MP Ali Fayyad called on the Lebanese state, the government army, and concerned parties to review the current performance, which has shown a complete failure to curb Israel's continued hostilities. MP also Qasem Hashem from the Amal Jamal movement, said that if such violations continue at this level, it is considered an occupation. And Lebanon has the right to defend its sovereignty and also has the right to defend its national dignity. So obviously, Hezbollah will not stay silent, or the resistance will not stay silent towards that. If Hezbollah is to retaliate, how do you see, where do you see things going?
We are going
a breakdown of the situation.
From my point of view, from my experience, I believe that the new Hezbollah will not be as the old Hezbollah. Hezbollah now, the whole Hezbollah resistance group, nobody will know anything about it. It will go underground again.
But Israel is bragging about demolishing weapons, a huge amount of weapons.
No, I'm talking as an organization. No one will hear about Hezbollah anymore. The armed group of Hezbollah will be working undercover, and no one will know who they are, where they are, when they are going to attack or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because due to the new technologies that obtained by the Israelis, Hezbollah must change its strategy,
exactly.
And it is changing its strategy, and we are going to see some military operations, very limited and effective, on the Israeli army inside the Lebanese soil, as it took place since 1983 till 2000, when Lebanon was freed from the Israeli army.
A U.S. envoy to Lebanon, Amos Hochstein, is expected to visit Lebanon after the new year. Why? Why is he coming to Lebanon, and how effective will this visit be?
Maybe, if I want to make a joke out of this, he's coming just to ask about his agents inside Lebanon, yani, because we all know that he has lots of people who love to work with this Zionist officer inside Lebanon, and they are not ashamed of that. They are very proud to be his close friends, yani. So after that, if I want to say, what's the use of him coming to Lebanon? Because Trump wanted to appoint a civilian, let's say, mandator, somebody who is going to be a general governor appointed by the Trump administration.
Yes.
And we must also know, and we should be carefully reading the future, the next day is appointing Antoine Brady, the right hand of Bashir Ismail, as an American ambassador inside Lebanon, will be working as an American ambassador into Lebanon. So Antoine Brady was one of the top officials of the Lebanese forces, mm-hmm, with Bashir Ismail at that time. We say Boulos Massad. Now Antoine Brady and Amos Hochstein. This is all a Zionist group gathering over to come to Lebanon and put this country under the American umbrella, mm-hmm, in the favor of the Israelis. So are we going to accept this? I don't think so, because we have suffered enough of the occupations and being controlled and ruled by a foreign country, and especially America.
Okay, moving on to Yemen, because Yemen's file is very important, especially amid the escalation. Yesterday, while the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, was giving his speech, Israeli warplanes targeted strategic sites in Yemen, including Sana'a International Airport, three ports along the western coast, power stations, as well as military infrastructure in the port of Hodeidah. Do you believe that Israel is dealing with the situation in Yemen just to save, despite the fact that this morning there was a huge escalation from the Yemeni side, we will discuss it. However, before that, do you believe that Israel is dealing with the situation in Yemen just the same way that it dealt with other fronts, or something is different here?
No, the only difference is just the distance, because Yemen is a bit far from the borders, and they depend on the carriers.
We're speaking about 2,000 kilometers.
2,000 kilometers, yeah. And they have to depend on the aircraft carriers inside the Red Sea and the Mediterranean to be able to launch their attacks, or to use other country air base to refuel and attack again. So first of all, I want to pay all my respects to the Yemeni leaders for what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
for the great support that they have provided to support the resistance inside Gaza and inside Lebanon. And they have shown and proved to the world that poverty will not stop anyone from fighting to protect his dignity.
Yes.
So if they think that those fighters who walk around with the slippers in their feet will not stop them to be a freedom fighters, mm-hmm. as the Americans like to use this term, a freedom fighters, when they want to twist the truth about any movement, that they can say that you are a terrorist or a freedom fighter, whatever they that serves the interest and the Americans.
Okay, so do you think that the Israelis failed in understanding this front specifically, or in analyzing this front specifically that is actually targeting, because in their perspective, Yemen is another act of the resistance, and just the same way that we conducted war on Hezbollah, on Hamas, and also on Yemen, are they working with a blind strategy, in your own opinion? Because at one point the Israelis were surprised with Yemen's capabilities, especially when it comes to the hypersonic ballistic missiles and all the developed technology over there. And as you're highlighting, it's a poor country, but at the same time it has a huge dignity, and it's working forcefully in solidarity with the Palestinians. Do you think that the Israelis lack information about who they're facing now? Because of course this is a major escalation without even calculating any retaliation.
I believe so. That's the only place that was miscalculated by the Americans and the Israelis is Yemen, because they didn't study Yemen well enough. Because
they thought
after 8 years of war, let's say between North and South, and with all the billions of dollars that spent by the Saudis to destroy Yemen, we see Yemen that has a great strategic point, very geographically, and second, the will, and they are prepared as an army to attack anywhere they want. And what we have seen this morning, that
exactly.
This missile
in less than 24 hours, Yemen.
Yes.
Yes, because yesterday we were watching the news and observing every action.
The day before that, about 30 casualties happened. It's casualties by the rockets, not
yeah.
by running over to get to
as
the shelter.
As a result of the iron bomb.
Exactly, no. And second, that today was 18 casualties also.
Yes.
And that will kind of paralyze the life inside Jaffa. So
yes, according to the Israeli regime's media, the missile strike targeted Tel Aviv. The attack prompted Israeli settlers to rush into the shelter, just the same way that we saw it two days before, when the Yemen also attacked, and it caused chaos
yeah.
among the Israeli settlers. But here, in less than 24 hours, I mean, Israel attacked the airport, and then in less than 20, and other locations, very strategic locations in Yemen, and then Yemen retaliated in less than 24 hours. I mean, we watched the news late last night, and this morning we were surprised with this steadfastness, and how they immediately decided to actually target, and they did not target any area. It's Tel Aviv. So another case, another case has been actually witnessed, or another case has been registered. However, the Iron Dome, that's the major thing here, Mr. Duan. The Iron Dome and the Israeli defense system, which cost billions of dollars, and Israel brags about it all the time, failed in intercepting this attack this morning also.
Just some specifications about the rockets. These are supersonic rockets, it's about 5 to 6 times faster than the sound, speed. No rockets can intercept this kind of...
No Iron Dome?
No, nothing.
Is it a developed one? Okay, so what kind of enemy is Israel dealing with here?
The Israelis now, first of all, I want to mention that they have, they're admitting that they have, or they're suffering from lack of information and intelligence information about Yemen.
That's why they asked for a coalition to attack Yemen.
Exactly. This is, and they have been working for a year just to indicate or to stop where the Houthi, Sayyid Abdul Malik Houthi, stays.
Yes.
So they want to maybe repeat the same action as Hezbollah or Hezbollah leader was, martyred, Sayyid Hassan
yes.
Nasrallah. So they want to assassinate Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi also. Mm-hmm. They have lack of information about that, and especially intelligence. And the most important that came up to the from the news yesterday, that the Yemenis caught a group of spies or agents working for the Mossad.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is only a small group. While we suffered in Lebanon from thousands of agents working for the Mossad,
they were observing the Lebanese ground since 2006, and many say that they were took a lot of information, and spies went into action since 2015, and that's why they had all this information. However, it's very important to actually highlight that this attack this morning also caused a shutdown of Ben Gurion Airport. It's come hours after Israeli warplanes conducted airstrikes on Yemen's capital Sana'a and the port city of Hodeidah, as we highlighted. So also here, the Yemenis are not only moving forward and targeting Israel, but they're targeting specific locations and very sensitive locations, allow me to say here. So what does this tell us? Does it tell us that the Yemenis, unlike the Israelis, they're the ones that have enough information about
exactly,
Israelis?
Exactly. That's, of course, they have shared information with Hezbollah. This is first,
okay.
Because Hezbollah has, huge information about the Israeli army everywhere in Palestine. If there is, the cooperation between the Houthis and Hezbollah, it's very clear. It's not hidden. It's something that everybody knows, that there is a cooperation between the two resistance, the two groups.
So you're saying all the actors of the resistance joined its forces to Yemen?
Of course. Yes. Why not? Because now we have a ceasefire, so why should Hezbollah stop from supplying information to the Houthis? Because things might escalate in the future, and the Houthis might be obliged to close down the Bab al-Mandeb and the Red Sea totally,
yes.
With nobody allows in, that stops the world trade coming in and out from these points. For everyone.
But Yemen was not satisfied with the maritime operation. They wanted more.
Yeah, they wanted more, and they can do more. They still, let's say, I don't want to say hesitating, but they're still dealing calmly with the situation.
Do you think there is more from where they came from?
They want to just deal with it as it needed. Now, if things break in a general war against the Lebanon or against Gaza or the Israelis launch a major attack over Yemen, things might change and change completely. And especially if we see that the Americans, they are threatening that they want to attack Iran itself, so things might break and we might see a major war ignited in the area, and nobody will know and expect the consequences of that.
Okay, and then how do you think that Israel will retaliate on these fresh attacks by the Yemenis today that targeted Ben Gurion and that targeted major sites inside?
Nothing. They will launch another air raid against Yemen. They're killing more civilians and attacking the country.
Launch more air raids or call for the coalition, the British and the U.S. to join the forces and targeting Yemen. They are already doing that.
The Americans and British have launched many air raids before. Now they are joined. We don't know if the Israelis themselves are doing those attacks on Yemen.
But they said that they're not behind it.
Because as we know, and I can assure that the attack on Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was done by American planes, American fighters. Mm-hmm. I mean, American pilots.
Israel rushed it. Rushed and actually denied it on. That they're not behind these attacks. They actually said that.
Yeah.
They rushed to deny it.
So
they said that the U.S. and the British, they're the one that conducted
these
strikes.
So we don't know if the Israelis are directly involved. But we are seeing that we are dealing with a coalition formed from Americans, British, German, and Israelis. So when we say attacked, we don't have to be very, you know, specific about who is attacking, because we are dealing is one camp,
mm-hmm.
and this camp is formed out of the NATO plus the Israelis, and we must not forget the role of Turkey, which is providing all the facilities to to the Israelis.
Mr. Redwan Rizik, a political analyst, thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today. Our
Thanks
time
a
is
lot.
Up.
Thanks.
Dear viewers, our time is up. We'll be here tomorrow with more political updates. Thank you for watching and stay tuned.
Israel Watch welcomes you. The ongoing situation in Syria continues to capture significant attention in the Hebrew media. There has been a noticeable shift in the perception of the new regime in Syria, with Israeli experts and commentators expressing concerns about the potential establishment of an extremist Islamic government supported by Turkey. Additionally, the Palestinian Authority's actions against the resistance in Jenin have received considerable analysis, along with discussions surrounding the ongoing negotiations for a captive exchange deal. To delve into these topics, we have our guest in the studio, Mr. Fares Ahmad, who closely follows Israeli affairs. Welcome, esteemed guest.
Thank you.
After the excitement experienced by the leaders of the Israeli entity following the fall of President Bashar al-Assad's regime, there has been a noticeable shift in how the new government in Damascus is perceived. The Hebrew media has expressed considerable doubts about the new regime's direction, suggesting the possibility of an extremist Islamic government under the auspices of Turkey.
נכון, וככל שמתעצמים הניסיונות האלה של אנשי תחריר השם בראשות אל-ג'ולני להציג למערב פנים ידידותיות כביכול, כך הולך ועולה מפלט החשדות כלפיהם בישראל. ההנחה בירושלים היא שארדואן מבקש להקים באמצעותם מדינת חסות ג'יהאדיסטית של טורקיה, שיהיה לה גבול משותף עם ישראל ברמת הגולן, ועל הרקע הזה אומר לנו גורם מדיני, הערכה היא שתקרית צבאית מול המורדים הסורים היא עניין של זמן. העברנו מסרים ברורים לג'ולני שלא נסבול את ירידת אנשיו לדרום סוריה, אבל אנחנו כבר מבחינים בניסיונות התגרות של חמושים שמתקרבים לאזור החיץ. נציין רק שחלק מהניסיונות האלה למיטב הבנתי היו של חמושים על טנדרים מסוג טויוטה ורכבי פיקאפ, תמונות שזכורות לנו לרע מימי דאש וכמובן מהשבעה באוקטובר, אז על הרקע הזה סביר להניח שההיערכות החזקה של צה"ל תימשך גם בגולן הישראלי וגם בגולן הסורי.
Why has the Israeli entity started to raise doubts about Ahmad al-Shaar, known as al-Jolani, after it had somewhat expressed its satisfaction with him, at least in the media?
Certainly, there was a desire from the Israeli side for the downfall of the former President Bashar al-Assad. Now they are actively encouraging this direction. With the regime's collapse, the Israeli perspective has become clearer regarding the situation in Syria, particularly in Damascus. The Israelis are keen on seeing the Syrian government and the state remain weak and fragile. They are concerned about whether this state might turn into a radical Islamic entity potentially supported by Turkey. There are many questions raised by the media about whether Turkey can handle the consequences of a radical Islamic state emerging beyond its control.
Do you think the Israeli doubts about al-Jolani might be linked to an attempt to distance themselves from any suspicion of collaboration, or do you believe it's more about trying to clear his name after refusing to resist the Israeli occupation of Syrian lands?
يعني بالتأكيد لا يوجد يعني تبييض لصفحة أي أحد يعني الجولاني معروف خلفيته.
There's definitely no withstanding of anyone's record here. Al-Jolani is well known for his background and how he came to power, often referred to as the Great Conqueror. He emerged from a very radical Islamic background and took control in Syria. His main actions have been superficial changes like shedding his military uniform and the extremist attire he used to wear, all to present a more palatable image to the West and to the Syrian public. What matters to Israel in all of this is that he remains compliant with their interests, and they want to push things much further than that.
They are concerned today about the possibility of an extremist Islamic regime supported by the Turkish state.
They are wary of any form of Islam, not just extremist Islam. Everything associated with Islam is taken very seriously by them. This is why they have pursued normalization with certain Arab countries that have an Islamic character, such as some Persian Gulf states, Egypt or Jordan. Currently, their focus is on Syria. They openly state that Israel has entered Qunaitara and some villages, and they have crossed into certain borders of Daraa province, with their sights set on Damascus. The situation presents two options, either a specific and defined normalization with Israel, or an incursion into certain areas, which would lead to those areas becoming completely isolated or entirely secured zones.
It's understandable, but do you think this is really concern, Professor Faris Ahmad, stems from the possibility that they fear al-Jolani could become a Turkish tool against them in their conflict with Israeli occupation.
It's clear that al-Jolani was largely under the influence of Jordan and the Turkish security apparatus, which set him a move and support him. Turkey's foreign minister meets Syria's new leader, delivering messages of support while receiving more embrace compared to other foreign ministers. This carries significant implications. They have stated, and Erdogan has made it clear and straightforward, that they support these characters, including al-Jolani. The most concerning statement made in Turkey is that this aligns with a Turkish national interest, which has very serious implications for Turkey's security within Syria.
This means that the confrontation between Turkey and the Israeli entity will take place at this time.
There won't be a confrontation, rather there will be a settlement. Washington's influence is still present, and it's Washington that is applying pressure on Turkey, not Israel. Certain agreements are likely to be reached.
In the same context, a former Israeli minister, Avi Dichter, stated that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham emerged from al-Qaeda and cannot easily change, expressing concern over the support and backing it receives from various Islamic and Arab nations.
מה שקרה, היי תחריר השם, HTS, הגוף הזה שהוא בסוף הוא מוטציה של אל-קאידה. צריך להבין, אחמד שרה, המכונה אבו מוחמד אל-ג'ולני, הוא יציר כפיה של תנועת אל-קאידה. האב הרוחני שלו היה איימן א-זווארי שחוסל, שהוא היה בן זוגו של אוסאמה בן לאדן.
כן, על ידי המשלמים.
זאת אומרת, האיש הזה לא גדל, אפרופו שר החקלאות, הוא לא גדל בערוגה שונה מהערוגה הזו. ולכן, כשאנחנו מסתכלים עליהם...
ככה ב-ג'יהאדיסט.com.
אלה ג'יהאדיסטים קיצוניים, איסלאמיסטים, שעסקו בטרור, לא בכדי, הוא גם היה מוגדר כטרוריסט בארצות הברית עם פרס לראשו. המאמץ שלהם, ואנחנו רואים עלייה לרגל, זה מדהים לראות איך ההנהגה המוסלמית, לא רק הערבית, עושה את פניה לעבר דמשק בהיקפים גדולים מאוד.
When the former Israeli minister Avi Dichter speaks about Hayat Tahrir al-Sham still wearing the guise of the terrorist organization al-Qaeda, what should we understand from this statement? This raises significant concerns.
This statement is somewhat accurate, as the Zionists often look at much deeper connection. They are tied to the roots of al-Qaeda, whether we like it or not. It's true that al-Jolani and his associates have moved beyond that during their time with Daesh, but for them, Daesh was just a phase. The al-Qaeda ideology still persists in the thoughts and beliefs of al-Jolani and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. There are certainly many negotiations happening around this issue, but what caught my attention is the interest from Arab countries in al-Jolani. There are certain Arab countries, as mentioned by Avi Dichter, that have shown concern about the potential spread of extremist Islamic ideologies, so they thought they need to reach Damascus for meetings with al-Jolani. This fear stems from the possibility of such ideologies taking root and creating internal unrest within these nations. It's important to note that while not everyone, a significant portion of the Syrian public and some supporters view this individual as an Islamic conqueror, which poses a serious risk.
There is an interesting question here, Professor Faris Ahmad. The Israelis are placing a lot of emphasis on Ahmad al-Shah, known as al-Jolani. It's worth noting that since 2011, he hasn't taken a clear stance against the Israeli occupation. It's well known that the biggest beneficiary in Syria today is indeed the Israeli entity.
This topic has two sides. The first aspect concerns Israel's strategy of instilling fear in its surroundings. They often present a narrative that suggests that they have the right to enter any area to confront what they label as terrorism, using this portrayal to justify their actions.
He classified them as terrorists.
They want to label their actions as fight against terrorism so they can justify entering any area under this protect. This is a very serious issue. Additionally, there is a question of whether the situation in the Golan Heights will unfold as we hope. The Israeli military has expanded its presence in many Syrian villages and towns, and we haven't heard much condemnation or reports of casualties. The only notable condemnation came from Syria's representative at the United Nations, while the response regarding the condition of the Golan Heights was quite brief.
In fact, Al-Jolani has said that he doesn't want new wars.
Yes, he said he doesn't want a new war for the Syrian people.
Development is priority.
You came in boldly claiming that you've conquered, but it seems you're not able to defend your own country from new invasions, aside from the existing ones from Turkey and the U.S., among others.
Let's shift our focus to the attacks launched by the Palestinian Authority security forces in Jenin, located in the occupied West Bank. These actions coincide with the assaults and incursions carried out by the Israeli occupying forces across various areas of the West Bank. Hebrew media has highlighted the significance of the PA's efforts to confront the weapons of Palestinian resistance in Jenin.
RPG.
RPG.
RPG, כן, אנחנו רואים הרבה את המלאך הזה, אנחנו רואים אותו המון בעזה, המון בלבנון, ומסתבר שיש אותו גם למחבלים באיוש. מי שמוצא את זה, זה מנגנוני הביטחון של הרשות הפלסטינית. הם מאתרים את ה-RPG הזה אצל מחבלים. יש המבצע שהמנגנונים כבר מבצעים כבר כמה ימים ברציפות בתוך מחנה הפליטים בג'נין, לראשונה מזה הרבה שנים שהם באמת
פועלים. רגע, פועלים. במבצעים המדהימים שצהל עשה שם,
לא מצאו. ניחוי,
לא מצאו הרבה
לא פליטים? מצאו. ועכשיו השאלה...
איך תדע אם יש שם טילים גם?
זאת עכשיו, עכשיו, זה עובדה. יש להם RPG. זה העובדה שצריכה להטריד את כולנו, את מערכת הביטחון ואת כולנו, שבאיוש למחבלים יש RPG. עד עכשיו ידענו שיש להם נשק, הרבה מאוד נשק, ידענו שיש להם מטעני חבלה, חומרי נפץ, עכשיו גם יש להם RPG. זה משהו שמחייב שיטה חדשה, אולי פעולה אחרת, זה פתאום זה יתברר.
לא גומרים.
לא, הזירות
לא
חוזרות אחרינו.
יפון, צפון,
עכשיו
דרום.
עכשיו שימי לב שבאמת
מטפלים בגדול פתאום באים הקטנים.
צה"ל עובד שם מאז תחילת המלחמה, קוטש שם. הרבה מאוד מבצעים חטיבתיים וחיסולים, מלא מלא הישגים, מלא אלפי עצורים, מחבלים מחוסלים, ובסוף פתאום מי ששולף שם RPG.
How do you explain this repressive campaign being carried out by the Palestinian Authority in Jenin against the resistance fighters?
This is a deeply painful topic for us as Palestinians, whether we are in the homeland or in exile. We have always hoped for unity within the Palestinian community. There are significant mistakes being made by the Palestinian Authority. It would have been more beneficial to engage in constructive dialogue based on a solid national foundation, regardless of who initiated the conflict or who has committed acts of aggression. Our common enemy is the Israeli adversary. Additionally, the Hebrew media is driving a wedge between the Palestinian Authority and all Palestinian factions by labeling the resistance fighters as troublemakers and suggesting that the PA should take actions against them.
One of the main supporters of the campaign led by the Palestinian Authority against the resistance is actually the Israeli side. What benefits does the occupation gain from it? Do you think there is some level of coordination between the two sides, specifically against the resistance in Jenin and the West Bank?
In this matter, let's clarify the concept of security coordination. While security coordination does exist, the Palestinian Authority is responsible for internal operations in Jenin, which is a significant mistake. However, there is no direct coordination with the Israeli occupation forces regarding this issue. It's important to understand that the security coordination encompasses not just the West Bank, but also Gaza before the conflict. What does security coordination entail? It involves the movement of people and goods, including all trucks entering Gaza and the West Bank, as well as import and export activities. This entire process is managed through what is referred to as security coordination, which is many branches. However, the situation in Jenin specifically highlights a major error made by the security forces of the Palestinian Authority.
ارتكبت الأجهزة الأمنية للسلطة.
ودفعت بالمعلق.
The Israeli commentator mentioned that the resistance forces have RPG weapons, indicating that it was the Palestinian Authority that revealed this issue, and that the occupation entity did not discover these weapons during its operations in Jenin.
The Hebrew media is being dishonest about this particular point, knowing full well that there are RPGs and more RPGs in the West Bank, and the authority also possesses RPGs. The aim is to suggest that there is a sophisticated weapon present in the Palestinian areas, particularly in the refugee camps. This would provide a pretext later on to justify all the operations of bombardment, occupation, and dismantling of active camps involved in resistance. This could be an attempt to provoke critical thinking. This scenario mirrors what happened in Jenin 24 years ago, when over 65% of the camp was destroyed, with the martyr Abu Jandal being a key figure in the resistance.
How do you evaluate the reality of the Palestinian resistance today in general in the West Bank, but specifically in the Jenin camp?
The resistance is currently at a disadvantage, and that's mainly because of the Palestinian Authority and those working in its security forces who are closely connected to their informants inside Jenin. This is quite a challenging situation, first because they find it exhausting to confront their own people while dealing with the Palestinian bloodshed. It's a significant struggle for them. On the other hand, they're also resisting the Israeli occupation in Jenin, Tulkarm, and the other refugee camps in the West Bank.
How do you see the special operations?
The special operations have been and will continue to be essential for all Palestinian factions in Jenin and beyond. The resistance efforts will persist in all their forms. However, we hope that all parties can quickly return to Palestinian dialogue. There are significant mistakes in the decisions made by the Palestinian Authority security forces regarding this issue that need to be addressed as soon as possible.
Let's move on, dear professor, to the ongoing discussions about the captive exchange deal. A former official from the Shin Bet has revealed that these negotiations in Qatar are progressing with a different dynamic, but we must wait to see the outcomes, as she stated.
זה לא בהכרח אומר שאנחנו מקבלים כל מה שאנחנו רוצים או שהם מקבלים, אבל יש דינמיקה וזה חשוב. אני חושב שהעובדה שיש נוכחות...
יש תהליך התקדמות.
כן, הנוכחות, שיש נוכחות בחירה מאוד של המוסד בקטר, בנציגות שם, שלא עזבה כל השבוע, ואותה נציגות בחירה יש גם של השבק במצרים, מעידה על זה. לא נותרנו אלא להמתין, אנחנו לא יודעים את כל הפרטים, גם אם נדע לא כדאי למסור אותם, אבל יש התקדמות, בואו נמתין. אי אפשר לדעת, זה הכל יכול להתהפך מחר.
Hamas has announced a freeze on negotiations regarding the captive exchange deal because the occupation entity has imposed new conditions. Netanyahu, as usual, is shifting the responsibility onto Hamas. What are your thoughts on this situation?
It is in Netanyahu's interest to obstruct the deal in order to achieve all his political goals domestically, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, which is closely linked to Gaza. Additionally, there are plans underway for East Jerusalem to be integrated, making it a unified city under the Israeli flag. This is all happening while waiting for a clearer political picture of the entire region, especially with Trump's impending return to the U.S. presidency. All these factors push forward delaying the deal until a complete picture is drawn. People are now questioning how the deal is being obstructed and what the points of connection are. Several key issues arise, the most significant being the names being discussed. There are certain individuals like Marwan Barghouti and Ahmed Sadat that Israel firmly refuses to consider in the deal. Another point of contention is regarding the prisoners who have been released. Will they remain within Palestine or be sent outside, similar to what happened in Bethlehem years ago during the Second Intifada? This is the second challenge. The third and most crucial point is whether there will be a withdrawal from the Philadelphia corridor, Netzarim, or even Rafah. Currently, if we look at the images, movements, and videos, the Israeli army has been working on establishing a comprehensive security system, essentially a small city along the Philadelphia corridor. They assert that this corridor and the security system will remain in place. It is transformed into something akin to a small village, equipped with all necessary amenities, including an air defense system and a full coordination with the Egyptian side. This system is quite extensive.
Do you think it's possible that Benjamin's conditions might change somewhat with Trump's arrival in the White House?
Changes may occur not drastically but partially. This could involve relinquishing certain areas such as handing over the Rafah crossing to the Egyptian side. A mutually agreed third party would manage the crossing. The Palestinian presidency could distance itself from Hamas by a certain distance. This is one of the scenarios being considered. Regarding the other axis, like the Salah ad-Din axis, there might be a complete withdrawal from this area, moving towards another axis. However, a key point in this discussion is the northern part of Gaza. Will there be a complete withdrawal from the northern region or will it be partial?
Let's shift our focus to the internal conflicts brewing within the Israeli entity, particularly among the ranks of the occupation military forces. There's a growing wave of criticisms directed at Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi and several senior generals close to him amid accusations of their failure to adequately take responsibility for the disaster that unfolded during the Operation Al-Aqsa flood on October 7, 2023.
תראי, מגי, אני חושב שבסופו של דבר, בתקופה האחרונה, שמענו הרבה מאוד ביקורות, חלק מגורמים פחות ידועים, וחלק גם מקצינים שהשתחררו לא מזמן מהצבא, אבל הפעם באמת אני חושב שמדובר על ביקורת שהיא די משמעותית, וכך אומר לנו בשיחה בכיר במערכת הביטחון על הרמטכ"ל ועל גם האלופים. הוא היה צריך לעוף הביתה מזמן, הוא וכל האלופים שהיו עם יד ורגל בשבעה באוקטובר, במקום שהוא ילך וייתן לצבא להתרפא ולהתכונן לאתגרים האדירים העומדים בפניו, הוא מתחקר את עצמו ומבצע מינויים לא ראויים בלשון המעטה. מדובר על ברווז צולע שנאחז בכיסא, מגי, ואני חושב שהדברים הללו בסופו של דבר הם משקפים הלך רוח דומה לא רק של הדרג המדיני. לאחרונה עוד אנשים מתוך מערכת הביטחון, חלקם בכירים לפחות שאני משוחח איתם, מציגים תמונה שפשוט מראה הרמטכ"ל כרגע לא מתפקד כמו שהיה מצופה ממי שעומד בראשות הצבא.
Well, Mr. Fares, the crises within the Israeli occupation army are not new, but the question arises, why is there an intensified campaign against Herzi Halevi, the chief of staff, holding him accountable for what happened during the Operation Al-Aqsa flood?
It is natural for him to bear this responsibility as a top military official still present in the system. Of course, Netanyahu finds it beneficial to direct all these accusations towards individuals or generals, whether they are security or military personnel. He has sacrificed some generals and dismissed others, like the Minister of War, while the Chief of Staff remains. He must take full responsibility. On the other hand, Netanyahu claims that he is holding accountable and punishing the officers who failed on October 7, presenting himself to the public as someone who is correcting mistakes rather than being at fault.
Is this a prelude to his dismissal?
Sure.
Because he has considered his dismissal.
Recently, he mentioned that the next phase might involve resignations, suggesting that he has several options to consider in the coming days. One of these options could be joining the opposition and becoming a prominent critic of Netanyahu. It seems there will be a reshuffling and redistribution of roles and responsibilities in the near future.
The challenges within the occupying army are numerous, including a recruitment crisis due to the loss of soldiers who were killed or injured in the wars in Gaza and Lebanon. How do you see the impact of these various crises on the occupying army, even if just briefly?
The occupying army, upon witnessing the overwhelming number of deaths and injured individuals, including those who are permanently disabled and unable to return to combat, experiences a significant drop in morale. They continuously request new soldiers to replace those who have fallen, seeking relief from their burdens. Additionally, there are calls for more frequent leaves, as the troops are exhausted from the numerous fronts they are facing. Overall, the Israeli army is feeling extremely fatigued and is eager for these crises to be resolved and for the current state of emergency to come an end.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fares Ahmad, for joining us in this episode of Israel Watch. Best wishes, dear viewers. Take care.
Israel again bombs Yemen, hitting the main airport and port city. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warns there's more to come. Another Houthi missile is fired at Tel Aviv in response. How dangerous are these escalating hostilities? This is Inside Story. Hello there, I'm James Bayes. Yemen again attacked by Israeli warplanes. Targets including the capital Sana'a and the port city of Hodeidah, a vital port for one of the world's poorest countries. Several people were killed while a World Health Organization team, including the Director General, were in the country's main airport when it was bombed. Another missile was fired afterwards at Tel Aviv by Houthi forces. Israel says there'll be more attacks, while the Houthis also show no sign of stopping. They've attacked Israel and Western shipping in the Red Sea since the war on Gaza began 15 months ago. So what's next? What's Israel's aim with these attacks? And what do they mean for Yemen and the wider region? We'll discuss all of this with our guests shortly, but first this report from Axel Zymovich.
An escalation of violence in Yemen as Israeli warplanes strike several targets across the country. The capital's airport was one. It was hit as World Health Organization delegation led by its director general was preparing to fly out on a UN plane. A crew member was injured.
A high-level delegation by the UN, headed by the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros, was at the airport when the strikes occurred. The delegation had just concluded discussions on the humanitarian situation in Yemen and on the release of UN and other detained personnel. Today's airstrikes follow around a year of escalatory actions by the Houthis in the Red Sea and the region that threaten civilians, regional stability, and freedom of maritime navigation.
The assault also hit the port city of Hodeidah, killing several people and injuring dozens of others. It serves as a vital lifeline for food and aid to millions of Yemenis. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will continue its attacks.
The Air Force attacked targets of the Houthi terrorist organization in Yemen, both on the coastline and in Sana'a. We are determined to root out this terrorist arm of Iran's axis of evil. We'll persist in this until we complete the job.
The Houthis then fired a missile into Tel Aviv, where some Israelis were injured as they rushed to get into shelters. This growing confrontation between Israel and the Iran-backed Houthis has sparked fears of a broader regional war. For more than a year, the Houthis have attacked commercial ships linked to Israel in what they say is a show of solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. But their actions in the Red Sea have severely disrupted global shipping routes and increased the cost of insurance. That's prompted attacks by U.S. and British forces.
The aggression against us will only increase the determination of the great Yemeni people to support the Palestinian people in fulfillment of our religious, moral, and humanitarian duty. The operations of the Yemeni armed forces will never stop until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege is lifted.
For a country devastated for years by civil war and a dire humanitarian crisis, the attacks by Israel are increasing hardship for its people.
I think the country, Yemen, does not have the capacity or the capability to deal with another crisis and another sort of strong actor that's intervening in their domestic affairs. Any miscalculation will probably devastate Yemen, and the country cannot handle that.
With Israel pledging to press on and the Houthis vowing to stand firm, Yemen could be drawn deeper into an expanding regional conflict. Axel Zymovich, Al Jazeera for Inside Story.
Before we talk to our panel of guests today, let's first go to Yemen's capital, Sana'a, where I want to bring in a pro-Houthi journalist and political commentator, Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. Thank you for joining us, sir. Can I start by asking you, what has been the reaction there to this latest Israeli series of airstrikes?
As I said, Abdul Malik, leader of Ansarullah, have said yesterday, and he has insisted that the military operation will continue. And the first reaction was in the early hour of today. Yemeni army has launched three attacks. One ballistic missiles have targeted the Ben Gurion airport in Tel Aviv, and another drone targeted a site in Tel Aviv. And as well, they have launched an attack with a number of drones targeting a ship called Santa Ursula in the Arabian Sea, east of Socotra Island. So this means that Yemeni message is clear that they will continue their attack despite the Israeli launching attack yesterday against Sana'a Airport and as well against the port of Hodeidah. And I just want to mention as well that the Sana'a Airport has returned as normal, and today the flights are going to the airport without any disturbance.
Now, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says they're going to continue their attacks until, he says, the job is done. Do you think there's any worry there among the Houthi leadership because of what we've seen has happened to leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah? Are they concerned there?
No, I mean, there is no worries about that. When they have entered this war against Israel because of their genocide in Gaza, they said clearly that the only way to stop their attack and to lift the blockade against Israel in the Red Sea and to stop attacking the Zionist state of Israel is when the Israeli regime will stop its attack and genocide and lift the blockade in Gaza and to withdraw from Gaza. If those demands are not met, this means that the Yemeni army will continue their attack, and they might as well expand their attack into Israel and as well maybe to target as well the port in occupied Palestine, because as we see that Israeli actually haven't got a clue about Yemeni army military installation as well. We've seen that they only keep targeting the port and airport for power station in Sana'a and Hodeidah, and this is exactly what the Saudi has done during 9 years of war. They have conducted more than 270,000 attack and strikes against Yemen, and those areas has been targeted hundreds of times. That's why Yemeni actually are used to this type of attack, and they will continue their attack against Israel. And I believe that Yemeni as well have one more escalation to come, and I believe that they could as well not only form a blockade against ships that are linked to Israel or shipping companies, but they could as well form a blockade against country that actually have a relation or support in Israel, like Germany. So Yemeni is the one who have the upper hand, and they are the one who control the Red Sea, and we've seen that as well the United States, and with more than 600 airstrikes against Yemen with the UK, this actually did not stop Yemeni attack, and we've seen that Yemeni now are conducting attacks against Israel on a daily basis.
So just to be absolutely clear, you're talking about possible expansion from the Houthi side, depending on what happens. To be absolutely clear, if there was a ceasefire tomorrow in Gaza, would all of this stop? Would the Houthis stop all of their attacks there and then?
It will stop, as they said here, that the battle of the Red Sea is the battle of Gaza. If there is a ceasefire is signed in Gaza and Hamas will approve that ceasefire, this means that Yemeni army here will stop their attack entirely, either in the Red Sea or against the Zionist state of Israel.
Your authorities there are taking an action on behalf of the people of Gaza, but the consequences are really bad, are they not, for the people there in a country that's one of the poorest in the region and has such a desperate humanitarian situation?
They are used to this type of attack, and Yemeni, we've seen that on a weekly basis, millions of people take up to the street here in Sana'a and in other major cities, and they all demand the Yemeni army to continue their attack, and as well demanding the Yemeni army and as well the leader of Ansarullah to expand their attack to target Israel with more missiles and more drones.
Hussein al-Bukhaiti, thank you very much for joining us from Sana'a. Well, let's now bring in our panel of guests today. And from Riyadh, we have Mustafa Noman, former Yemeni Deputy Foreign Minister. From Tel Aviv, Yossi Beilin, a former Israeli Cabinet Minister. And from Brussels, Elijah Magnier is a military and political analyst. Thank you all for joining us today on Inside Story. If I can start with you, Elijah, we've seen these clashes going on. We've seen attacks coming from Israel. We've seen Houthi attacks on Israel for some considerable time now. Is this expanding into a full-scale conflict?
I don't think it's going to go to a full-scale war as in Lebanon and in Gaza because of the distance. Israel is 1,700 to 2,000 kilometers away from Yemen, and it does need indeed the support of the U.S. to participate directly in any military operation that Benjamin Netanyahu would like to carry out against Yemen. This is in his mind. This is what he said. And he also anticipated that it is not going to be a unilateral effort, but it's going to be a joint operation with the United States, which is true. Nevertheless, we've seen examples in the past, in the last month, or since the 7th of October, we did not see a larger escalation even with the war on Gaza and with the war on Lebanon. Therefore, we have seen it always contained within specific theater, which is something that is also suitable for Benjamin Netanyahu. So we have to see if the United States are going to participate in a large attack against Yemen. Israel needs intelligence information about location and to assassinate leaders, as he also anticipated and told us. And we have to see if this is feasible, particularly in the light of Yemeni learning from what happened in Lebanon and in Gaza and drawing the conclusion and taking countermeasures to a possibility of a destruction in Yemen similar to the one in Lebanon.
I'd like to start with you, Yossi, just to get some idea of what ordinary people think there right now about the situation. How is this being seen? Is there fear and panic? And do the public support Israel's actions?
By and large, I believe that the public is supportive because there are no issues between the Houthis and Israel. Israelis have not heard about the Houthis until, I think, quite recently. And they watch TV, they watch the spokesperson there who reminds them the spokespersons in North Korea with the kind of way they speak and threaten. And they don't know just exactly what do they want from us. I mean, right, it is clear that they want us to end the war. Many people in Israel want to end the war, but they don't want and are not going to support ending the war only because of the Houthis. So their idea that by launching missiles, ballistic missiles against Israel every night and wake up, make a kind of a wake-up call for all of us, millions of people in the middle, in the center of Israel, Israel will decide to end the war. I don't think that this will be the case. And I do think that a coalition of countries which understand how crazy this situation is, will help in creating a kind of a blockade on this poor country. Really, it is a shame that we have to do these things, that Israel has to bombard the airport and all these things to this poor place, but we don't see any other way out of this kind of situation, and it can go on, it cannot go on forever.
Mustafa, let me bring you in on that point. Your country is one of the poorest on earth. The UN currently estimates, I think, over the next year, 19 million people will need humanitarian assistance. And this clearly was highlighted by the fact that the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros, happened to be at Sana'a Airport when it was bombed. The UN Secretary General says as a result of the humanitarian dimension, he found the attacks especially alarming. Do you think anyone, though, in the world is listening to comments like that from the UN Secretary General?
Unfortunately, nobody's listening to it. But let me say that what the Israeli army is doing by bombarding civilian sites is not, under no circumstances, can be equated to what the Houthis are doing in Israel. I'm not saying here that we are supporting what the Houthis are doing, but I'm saying even the reaction of the Israeli army is not proportionate to what the Houthis have been doing. The Houthis have been saying this for 12 or 13 months now, that they aren't what they call the axis of support to Gaza. They have not seen they don't want to see what happened to the Gazans by the Israeli war machine, and then in Lebanon, and then in Syria recently. And that will continue even if the Houthis do stop the attacks towards Israel. There is a consensus in the international community that the power that the Houthis have now has to be decimated. And this is what the Israelis are doing wrongly. They are not attacking military sites. They are attacking civilian targets that do not harm the Houthis directly. The Houthis do not care about what happens to these civilian targets that have been attacked by the Israelis. I don't understand the logic behind choosing or picking these sites, the port and the airport. I cannot get any positive reaction about why. Why these
okay.
targets?
Let me bring in Yossi then on that particular point. I mean, I was reading the statement from the Israeli military. It's described two of the places they'd attacked as military infrastructure used by the Houthi terrorist regime, this is the quote, for its military activities. Those were two power stations. Those are civilian sites, were they not?
I'm speaking, I mean, I was asked about the airport. The point is that the two airports, the seaport and the airport, are the doors through which Iran is sending ammunition to the Houthis. This is the point, and this is why they were targeted. Israel is not trying to target civilian aims and targets, and as you know, I mean, the Houthis are only targeting civilians. I mean, they are targeting me every night, so I can testify. I spent some long minutes, if not more than that, in the middle of the night in shelters. So they do attack civilians. So they are the last to complain about something like that. But I can say to you, It is something that it is very difficult for me to defend and say this is our aim. We should kill Houthis and whatever. Who needs it? Who needs it? It is really crazy. They should understand. They will not stop the war in Gaza. The war in Gaza will be stopped, but not by them. And they should understand that they are damaging their own country, their own people, as it happened with Hamas. And they should stop it. If they don't stop it, then Israel will not have any other choice but trying to help create a coalition which will stop it.
Okay, Elijah, let me bring you in on what they've been targeting, because the targeting that they've gone for in this most recent attack looked pretty similar to the targets they went for the last attack. I mean, it sounds like they don't have that many options and perhaps don't have very good intelligence.
Well, no, it looks like the Israelis don't have many options. They don't have enough information and they don't have a bank of objectives because of the distance and because the Israelis never thought they're going to go and fight the Ansarullah Houthis in Yemen. Secondly, yes, indeed, Israel has many choices. First, to stop killing the civilians in Gaza. Second, stop destroying Gaza. Third, to allow the people to live and to break the siege on Gaza. The Houthis did not start by bombing Israel. They started with the maritime blockage, and they said, lift the blockage on Gaza, we will lift the blockage on you. But the Israelis went on. They didn't care because Benjamin Netanyahu had different projects and because Benjamin Netanyahu had the project to eliminate the presence of the Palestinians, at least in the first part of the north of Gaza, and bring back the settlements and settlers to the north of Gaza, displace forcibly all the Palestinians. That is the heart of the problem. And Ansarullah said it, that they are supporting Gaza from the humanitarian approach. And because the ICC considered Benjamin Netanyahu as a war criminal, rightly because of his acts in Gaza, this is why Yemen took up the fight to support the people in Palestine.
Okay, let me bring in Mustafa now. I mean, if Israel decided to pursue an extended military campaign against the Houthis, is there anyone who's going to stop them? Because a few months ago, the US was warning about regional escalation and saying there must not be regional escalation. But since what's happened in Lebanon, they seem to be very, very quiet. And potentially on the horizon, in just over a couple of weeks' time, you have got a new president of the United States. And we know the US has also been carrying out its own attacks against the Houthis. There's the possibility, is there not, Mustafa, that they could join forces?
First of all, I want to correct you. See, I mean, the airport in Sana'a is not used to bring in military equipment. The only we have one daily flight from Sana'a to Amman. That's what the airport is doing. No other flights reach Sana'a except this flight of Yemenia from Amman, Sana'a to Amman, Amman to Sana'a. That's one. The second is the port in Hudaydah is observed and monitored by the UN. So nothing comes to the port unless it's monitored and approved and agreed upon by the coalition that's led by Saudi Arabia and monitored by the UN. Now, going back to what the Israelis can do in Sana'a, there is nothing that they know about and can be targeted. They have been the US and the UK have been targeting Sana'a now for 3 or 4 months as a response to the attacks of the Houthis on the Red Sea. But what happened? Nothing. And now to go after these civilian targets, that makes the case of the Houthis more solid on the ground, that they have been attacked by Israel, the enemy, and been attacked by the US and UK. And they love it. They love it as a PR to their own supporters, that now they are in a war for Gaza against Israel and the United States and the UK. So the case, the political case is lost. And the ethical state is already lost because what are you attacking? Do you want to punish the Houthis or do you want to punish the Yemeni population? What has been done is it's a punishment to the population that has no word or has no say in what the Houthis are doing either against Israel or inside the country. So we cannot by any means equate what the Houthis are doing and what the Israelis, the US and the UK are doing against Yemen. Me as a Yemeni and I'm an opponent to Houthis cannot but condemn what is happening in my country. I mean, destroying what we have built by our own money, we cannot condone this. Whatever the Houthis are doing in the country against the population, but being attacked by an outsider, that's something that we can never tolerate and we can never welcome to do, even if we want Houthis to vanish now. That's unacceptable to me.
Yossi, I mean, as I said before, we've got Trump coming into office pretty soon. Already the US and the UK are having their own separate attacks on the Houthis. Operation Poseidon Archer, I believe, is the code name for that. Do you think it's possible that Israel will persuade Trump to join in with their operations?
Yeah, I think that it is possible. I mean, the point with Trump is that he is totally unexpected. But being unexpected as he is, I think that he is open to such a persuasion. And God knows what will happen as a result of it. By the way, I agree that the issues which we are witnessing in the last 14 months or 15 months is the issue of the inability to separate between the leaderships and populations. It happens on the Arab side, on the Israeli side, and whoever is raising this point is right. But what can you do? I mean, the leaders are hiding behind this population. And the idea is that if the population is hurt, it will have some kind of impact on their leaders to stop the violence. I mean, I really don't see something different than that. I mean, I would like to ask you, are anti-Houthi, but you are a Yemenite, a patriotic Yemenite. You see what is happening. What would you do in such a situation?
Okay, Mustafa, question to you.
Well, I will tell you something. I mean, there are so many ways to punish the Houthis. You have the financial measures that have been taken against the Houthis. You have to put more inspectors and more inspection on at the port of Hodeidah, so you make sure that there will be no new arms coming to them. That's the only way. But to punish the population for what the Houthis are doing or planning to do in the future, it's not the Yemeni population say. I'm one of those who have been tweeting for months that whatever the Houthis are doing against Israel might look like a patriotic act to support the Palestinians, but the reaction is that it's not helping the Gazans even there. What are we doing there? I mean, I want to help Gaza. I want to stop this genocide in Israel and Gaza. But what the Houthis are doing is not right. It's not helping, at least.
100%.
So there are so many measures. There are measures that can be taken. More inspection, block the Hodeidah port, but don't destroy it. You are destroying our own installation that we have been building for 50 years.
Okay, I'd like to bring in Elijah again now as our military analyst, because in this discussion, I think we've got to remember the geography of the situation, because Israel bombing Gaza or Lebanon is very different from bombing Yemen. The distance between Tel Aviv and Sana'a is over 2,000 kilometers. Does that create problems for Israel if it did want to start an extended campaign?
It creates a huge problem. Not only that, but also the geography. Israel is 22,000 square kilometers. Yemen is more than 527,000 kilometers, of which Ansarullah controlled two-thirds. So having a vast territory has less effect on Ansarullah when the Ansarullah can fire against Israel and with a small geography, and they can hit the heart of it. But yes, again, in the course of all this war, we've seen only 210 missiles fired from Ansarullah and 175 drones only, which is equivalent to what Hezbollah fired in one day, just a few days before the cessation of hostility. And also from the Israeli...
Hello, welcome to Half an Hour of Jazz, live and direct from the Penthouse on King FM. Coming to you live and direct from the Penthouse, regular weekly feature here from 9:30 to 10 o'clock. Tonight we have Wes Montgomery on guitar, and in the first half of the program featuring the Wynton Kelly Trio.
The best New Year's deals are happening now at Tanger Outlets. Celebrate with up to 70% off savings from Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. From activewear to accessories, beauty and apparel, find everything you're looking for to kickstart the new year. The clock is ticking. Hurry into Tanger Outlets to save more. Hundreds of brands, unbeatable value. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. The best New Year's deals are happening now at Tanger Outlets. Celebrate with up to 70% off savings from Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. From activewear to accessories, beauty and apparel, find everything you're looking for to kickstart the new year. The clock is ticking. Hurry into Tanger Outlets to save more. Hundreds of brands, unbeatable value. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.